Now an essay from our new summer reading series, Three Books. We're asking writers to recommend three of their favorites on a specific theme. This week, Mark Acedo and the classic American archetype, the suburban housewife.
I'm sure there was a mix-up in the cosmic paperwork. I mean, I'm a gay guy with a trendy haircut, a ready wit, and the same waist size I had in junior high. So how did I end up trapped in deepest suburbia? As a result, I'm a huge fan of books about desperate housewives. Reading stories about smart, funny women who were miscast in their lives is like having a marathon phone call with your best girlfriend, assuming your best girlfriend is hilarious, brilliant, and completely honest. A perfect example is the compulsively readable We Are All Fine Here by Mary Gooderson, in which a married woman finds herself pregnant after a liaison with her old boyfriend in the bathroom at a friend's wedding. You know those friends who are constantly screwing up, but you secretly enjoy it because it makes you feel better about your own life? That's what reading this book is like. We Are All Fine Here delivers Hitchcockian suspense without anyone being chased by a crop duster or rappelling off Abe Lincoln's nose. From page one, questions abound. Who is the baby's father? Who will the heroine end up with? How much longer can she hide her morning sickness? These questions and more will be answered as the stomach turns. In contrast to the friend who screws up is the friend who's got it all together. For that, you must turn to Mrs. Miniver by Jan Struthers. Forget the melodramatic MGM weepy with Greer Garson. This slyly comic story of a well-bred Englishwoman on the eve of World War II fascinates me with such pressing concerns as, how do you find a charwoman on short notice? And what do you say at a shooting party? But Mrs. Miniver's contentment with her privileged life is tempered by her wry observations, like how she longs to invite the scintillating half of the couples she knows to dinner, then invite the boring ones another night that she could cancel. It's like Mrs. Dalloway for dummies. The best literary friend of all, however, is the narrator of Nora Ephron's Heartburn, who is the perfect synthesis of the first two, a mild screw-up who still has her head screwed on straight. Long before Nora Ephron felt bad about her neck, she wanted to wring the neck of her philandering husband. Because the novel is reportedly based on Ephron's own calamitous marriage to journalist Carl Bernstein, it's difficult to imagine anyone other than the acerbic author herself in the role, even after Meryl Streep played her in the movie. This book proves the adage that writing well is the best revenge. The heroine of Heartburn writes cookbooks, which is appropriate given Ephron's totally edible prose. It's a delicious book, one you alternately want to gorge on yet savor, and the kind of hilariously wise and well-observed novel that makes readers wish the author were their best friend and makes writers like me contemplate suicide. While I lead my own life of quiet desperation, however, I depend on these fictional friends the way I do my real ones, for comfort and laughs and inspiration. I take solace in knowing that there are others in the same boat, especially if that boat is dry-docked in deepest suburbia.
That was writer Mark Acedo, author of Attack of the Theater People, recommending his three favorite books on a theme, the theme being the suburban housewife.
Paolo Bacigalupi's first book is a collection of science fiction short stories called Pump Six. It's filled with ecological themes drawn in part from his friendships with scientists who live in his hometown of Paonia, Colorado. Rick Kleffel of member station KUSP has more.
Paolo Bacigalupi began writing as an escape from his day job at a technology company. He was depressed and hated the work. He sought solace writing science fiction. His first novel met with no success. It was so dark that one editor rejected it, saying, "As a mother, this disturbs me." So he decided to try his hand at short fiction and had instant success with his story, Pocketful of Dharma.
That one went out and it sold immediately, and Gordon Van Gelder put it on the cover of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and I thought, aha, here I am, I've arrived. Then I proceeded to not write any more short stories for something like 4 more years.
Instead, he followed this up with an adventure set in China, a contemporary novel about the people and landscapes of Colorado, even a postmodern Western.
It was only after I had written all of these novels and not sold any of them that I sat down and thought, well, I actually sort of liked writing science fiction, and I actually had some success writing short science fiction. Gee, maybe I ought to go back to that and try it again. You know, the one door that opened for me a little bit, maybe I should lean on that door.
Bacigalupi returned to the realm of science fiction. In this passage from his story, The Calorie Man, After genetically engineered diseases have wiped out crops in India, two immigrants end up in a devastated New Orleans.
And wasn't that why Shriram had come to him? Shriram, who knew more of his history than any other. Shriram, who had found him after he arrived in New Orleans and known him for a fellow countryman. Not just another Indian long settled in America, but one who still spoke the dialects of desert villages and who still remembered their country as it had existed before Jean-Hack Weevil, Leaf Curl, and Root Rust.
Science fiction writers make a huge contribution to the debate.
Michelle Nyehaus was trained as a biologist and works as an environmental journalist. She lives in the same small town in Colorado.
I mean, I love to see science fiction like Paolo's that jumps off of some real science, you know, jumps off of what we know about the modern world, because I think that has more relevance.
Bachi Galupi takes the environmental themes Nyehaus documents and projects them into an unpleasant future.
She goes out and sounds out information that then I can sit around and think, now, what does that really mean for us?
Paolo Bachi Galupi continued to have success with short science fiction, which got the attention of publisher Jeremy Lassen. His Nightshade Books is based in California.
The large New York conglomerates and their science fiction imprints are geared towards a certain numerical threshold. So there's a lot of opportunity in the marketplace for smaller publishers because I don't have the huge overhead that a large publisher does, and I can sell fewer copies and still have it be a profitable part of my business plan.
Lassen's distribution reaches into both independent and chain bookstores.
I can point out the high points of short fiction and say, well, this guy is really doing cutting-edge stuff or is an important part of the genre dialogue. You know, if I can make that case for a collection, I can do okay with it.
In the process of crafting the short stories, Bachi Galupi built a world in which to set his next project, a novel, a form much more attractive to mainstream publishers.
It's a political spy novel all focused on genetically modified foods. Everybody's trying to find a seed bank and trying to find new genetic diversity. It's cloak and dagger stuff, but with grain.
Paolo Bachi Galupi hopes that potential readers already interested in the environment will also have an interest in his ecologically themed works. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
Benny Ford is stuck on a plane at Chicago O'Hare, caught in some purgatory between coasts and a life filled with regrets and the wedding of the daughter, whom he barely knows. He checks the departure board for updates. He shifts in pinching plastic seats he calls O'Chairs. He trades small talk with his fellow passenger internees. And finally, he starts writing a letter of complaint to American Airlines, demanding a refund. But within a few pages, it becomes apparent that the real refund Benny Ford would like is on his life. Dear American Airlines is the title of Jonathan Miles' new novel. It has been praised by writers as diverse as Jim Harrison and Elizabeth Gilbert. Mr. Miles, who was the cocktail columnist for the New York Times, and did you even know they had one, and the book columnist for Men's Journal, did you even know that they had one, joins us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Was it a specific flight that inspired you, or more like 100?
It was a specific flight, although there's the influenced by hundreds of terrible ones. I was flying to from Memphis, near where I lived at the time, to New York, and instead of going to O'Hare for my 45-minute layover, we landed in Peoria, put on this secret bus line that the airlines keep, bus to O'Hare, where there's this now familiar scene of hundreds of consumer refugees, some people sleeping on cardboard boxes, appliance-sized cardboard boxes, where I have no idea how they procured those in the airport, but they had them. I was jealous. And I spent the night under the table at the Wolfgang Puck restaurant in O'Hare. I started composing this enraged letter to American Airlines on my own behalf. The problem was I didn't have the situation to justify this rage. You know, it's the rage you feel when you're on hold for 45 minutes, this sort of disproportionate rage. But I'm looking around the airport thinking somebody is missing something essential. Somebody is watching a last chance at something slip away, and I wondered what that rage would sound like. And then was born Benny.
Hmm. Let's talk a bit about Benny. He's 53, a frustrated to failed poet, translator, and a very unfulfilled father.
Benny is trying to get to the wedding of a daughter he hasn't seen in 27 years, and she was basically an infant. To his mind, this is perhaps his last chance to atone for for a great number of sins and to make things right.
He surprises his daughter, the reader, and perhaps that matter even himself, when he impulsively asks his daughter on the phone, "Can I walk you down the aisle?"
Yeah, this is an old promise he made to her before she even could understand the words of a promise, but just something you say to a little tiny baby girl. You know, he said, "I'm gonna hate it one day when I walk you down the aisle." Nobody seems to remember this line except Benny, but he has latched onto it, in the manner of somebody clinging to driftwood in the ocean, and that line, that old promise, is what he thinks might redeem him. And unfortunately, the airline steps in.
As we noted, you're the drink columnist for the New York Times.
Yes.
Cocktails come in for some roles in this book, don't they?
Benny is an alcoholic. And in some sense, that might seem hard to reconcile, the fact that you know, I write about cocktails in a celebratory way, and I'm writing about Benny in just the opposite. But for me, alcohol has this endless fascination, that there's this substance that can enhance life so beautifully and destroy it so completely. And I think it's why I tend to enjoy finding stories in bars for the Times, and then for Benny, this is where you see people very often at their happiest and their saddest, at their best and at their worst. You know, that's just fascinating to me, that this substance can do all that.
In his conversations with his daughter, and he's a man of words, he's a translator, literary translator, has been a poet, he often finds himself sounding stupid. I mean, the one area that you would of expertise that you would think he still has at his command.
Benny has a love and a grasp on language, except when language is most necessary. He can find, you know, he can find the words for pretty much anything except for these things that actually matter. And he's able to construct this alternate life, this alternate universe, and I think it's his great flaw. And I think we all, to some degree, do this. And, you know, it's the sin that Camus wrote of, you know, the sin against life in hoping for another life or waiting for another life. And you know, Benny constructs this alternate universe, this alternate sense of who he is. And when he's forced to actually face reality, he doesn't have the language for it. He doesn't have the words for it.
I think it's safe to say that the purgatory metaphor looms large in your book.
It does. And you know, I find airports to be purgatorial in many ways. I mean, even from the basics of the design, you know, the sort of this muted gray and the fluorescent lights, you know, as Dante wrote, you know, that in purgatory nobody cast a shadow, and, you know, it just seems like airports are these shadowless places, and you have, instead of the guards with their swords, you have your TSA screeners. And but also that worked for Benny, because this truly is a very purgatorial moment for Benny, and metaphorically speaking, and, you know, this is the moment where he decides, more or less, whether he ascends or descends.
He's an expert in Eastern European languages and literature.
His father was Polish, and a survivor of a labor camp, Nazi labor camp, came to the U.S. and married a New Orleans woman after pregnancy, and informally taught him Polish. And Benny thinks of this as sort of magical incantatory language that his father, you know, gave to him, the one gift that his father was able to give to him. His father died young, and that is the one thing he's been able to cling to. I see Benny is almost being contaminated by literature. You know, Benny's misguided romanticism. You know, this idea, as Pablo Neruda wrote, you know, that you should run through the streets howling, you know, wielding a green knife, you know. And Benny was the type to read that and think, oh, well, I need a green knife, you know, to take literature quite literally. Being, you know, almost, you know, infected by literature, but at the same time, maybe brought out of that and by literature as well. And this comes from a Polish novel that he's intermittently translating, or at least, you know, dipping into while he's stranded.
And I think we can say this carefully. His daughter, whose wedding he's trying to reach, was a surprise.
Yes, his daughter was a surprise. As Benny was an accident, so too was his daughter. An accident begat an accident. This was not the life that Benny had planned for himself. He wanted, you know, poetic languor. He wanted, you know, this sort of the ecstasy of languishing and this artistic libertine existence. But and then he found himself with, you know, trying to figure out how to which way a diaper goes,
and upbraided for not knowing the right way.
That's right. That's right. So he fled, and years later, now he's looking back at that at what he did and trying to come back as best he can.
Jonathan Miles, his new novel is Dear American Airlines. Mr. Miles, awfully nice talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Universities teach all kinds of writing, technical, science, creative fiction. Now there's a textbook for another kind of literature, comics. Really? It's called Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, a definitive course from concept to comic in 15 lessons. Jessica Abel and Matt Madden are the cartoonists who wrote the new textbook. They join me from WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks very much for coming in. Hi.
Hi.
So a textbook for comics?
That's right.
Absolutely.
Why did you write it?
Well, we've been teaching comics for 7 years, and we've gone through several sort of iterations, generations of students, and a lot of the stuff that's in the textbook comes out of our teaching. And it also comes out of an understanding and awareness as we've been around the country doing talks about various comics that we've done, that there's just a real hunger for information about comics and how do you make comics. They're very complicated. You know, it's very difficult to do. It's not just something you can sit down and figure out intuitively very quickly. I mean, you can do it, but it takes a long time.
That's how Jessica and I learned, was the very long, and the way most cartoonists do learn, and probably many will continue to learn, is this very slow catch-as-catch-can process of picking things up piecemeal and learning through trial and error. So we're trying to speed that process up a little bit.
Yeah, my very first thought was, oh, I can't draw. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to be any good at making a comic.
But then I hope you turn to page 6.
I did.
Or was it
page 9.
Page 9. I opened the book and can't draw? Read this. And there are several really great examples of comics that, you know, one is made entirely of little dots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very effective. So I guess you don't have to draw.
Right. It's not to downplay the importance of art and drawing in comics, because obviously they're crucial, but it's more that there's a wide range of ways that you can approach telling stories visually. I think a lot of people are so intimidated when they see this, you know, elaborately illustrated work that they think, oh, I could never do that. But that's just one kind of comics.
I love in the opening part of the book the welcome that you guys have drawn.
Mm-hmm.
It shows the two of you, and you're walking through a series of panels as the characters that will appear later in the book are preparing to come onto the stage. So you've got this guy, Nate. This is you, Matt Madden, saying, Nate, you're on in about 10 pages, and he's stretching, limbering up.
Right.
To get ready to come into the book. But what occurred to me while I was looking at the book and looking at this series of panels is that there's timing in comics, isn't
there? Oh,
sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
a lot of it is about pacing and rhythm.
If you look at the intro comic, for example, you'll see that the first panel is quite quick, and it's we just say who we are. Hi, I'm Jessica, and I'm Matt. And then the next panel is a little bit wider.
Uh-huh.
And that's where you see Nate on the floor stretching out. And that gives you a little bit of a pause. And then there's another panel that's a little bit narrower, and there's a giant whoosh and a bunch of motion lines coming down, which you read quite quickly. It points right at the next panel where the character who is whooshing by has landed.
There are all these other little lines and squiggles and, you know, like when a character has like little sweat beads kind of jumping off their heads,
right.
or like a squiggle over their heads to show that they're kind of like annoyed or put out.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What are those?
We actually have a name for those, which we borrowed from the cartoonist Mort Walker, the guy who did Beetle Bailey. He coined a term, emanata, things that emanate. And he meant it very tongue-in-cheek. And in fact, he went through and cataloged all of these things. So the flying sweat beads are known as pludes, P-L-E-W-D-S, pludes.
Which is not to say we don't call them
right.
pludes.
Right, so he actually classified them all, and he has an extensive list of names, like briffets for speed lines. I forget what. They're, you know, all kinds of silly names. So we didn't take the whole hog like that, but the notion of having a term to describe these kind of emotional markers in comics is very useful, because they're part of the comics language and something that's very unique to comics.
They're non-literal pictorial elements that express something narrative.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very often they're thought of as a very silly kind of thing, the same way the pow sound effects are. But in the right hands and with like a little bit of thought about them, they can also be very subtle storytelling tools. It's a matter of finding a range of things that you can do with these the narrative tools that comics use.
You guys are pretty serious about the funny pages.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you've ever read our comics, they're pretty serious too, actually, I have to say. But we don't mean to take all the fun out of this, and I really think that actually this doesn't take all the fun out of it. If you're into comics and you're drawing the stuff, even though we're treating it in a very serious way, you know, many of our students use all of these tools to do really funny stuff.
Jessica Abel and Matt Madden are co-authors of the new comic textbook, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, a definitive course from concept to comic in 15 lessons. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Patrick Hemingway is 80 years old today. We'll get to say happy birthday in just a moment. He had a complicated birth, which his father, Ernest Hemingway, used to inform a similar scene in A Farewell to Arms, the same year that Ernest Hemingway's father took his life, as the writer, of course, would years later. Ernest Hemingway once wrote that he remembered, quote, the fine times and the bad times we had in that year, but much more vividly, I remember living in the book and making up what happened in it every day, finding you were able to make something up, to create truly enough so that it made you happy to read it, was something that gave me a greater pleasure than any I'd ever known. Patrick Hemingway, who spent much of his life as a safari guide in Africa, joins us now from Helena, Montana. Happy birthday, Mr. Hemingway.
Thank you.
Over the years, what happens when people who don't know you hear your name? Do people just shake your hand and say, ooh, any relation?
Well, I think the funniest incident I ever had was a friend of my dad's and also a friend of mine who is a professional gambler in Las Vegas, and we visited, and he wanted to set things up for me, a nice trip to Vegas, and he made a reservation for us at one of the principal casinos for the restaurant, and we went there, and the maitre d' came over, and he said, oh, Mr. Hemingway, he said, I read everything you wrote. I mean, this was about 15 years ago. I read everything you wrote, and my favorite is The Grapes of Wrath.
Well, lucky no Steinbeck kids walked in that to that place.
Yes, right. But that's sort of it, you know. I mean, either I have a conversation with people who really know about Hemingway and his role in American literature and world literature, for that matter, or he's just another name, you know.
Timely question. I notice in separate accounts that both John McCain and Barack Obama, in various interviews, have mentioned A Farewell to Arms as being among the novels they have read and treasured most.
Yes, I think it is unquestionably, in my opinion, his greatest novel. Greatest work, really. There's a quality about it that I think one appreciates more and more. It's the sense of a person coping with great events.
I hope you don't mind me asking. There is a shadow of suicide in your family line between your grandfather, your father, your niece, Margot. You read all kinds of speculation as to, is there a genetic basis, chemical basis, a genetic basis that gets aggravated by chemicals, mostly meaning alcohol. Is it depression? Is it circumstance? I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that you wouldn't mind sharing.
I'm not really competent to say. I will say this, though. Mm-hmm. There's a tendency in the public to want to endow all geniuses with some sort of madness. I think it must be envy on their part.
I hate to sound like a psychiatrist, but go with that. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, to be a great writer, there's what, 3 or 4 of them in every generation. And people have to accept this. It's not democracy.
Do you read your father often?
Pretty often, because I have a commercial interest.
So you've always got to be seen reading it on an airplane so that people...
No, I have to read it in order to be competent in the marketing of it, in the management of it. And we have done a very good job, I think. I mean, compared with the other writers of his competitors in his generation. If you go into a bookstore, there's more Hemingway available than there is Faulkner or there is Fitzgerald.
May I ask, if it's not indelicate, you know, every now and then you'll see an ad for like a, you know, a Hemingway furniture line.
Oh yes, the what we call our commercial arm. Yes, and actually, the Hemingway line when it came out was a tremendous success because that was the time when people were building big homes, and the Hemingway line of furniture tend to be pretty massive. You know, a sort of Texas style.
Mm. Yeah, Papa's sofa.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, the whole concept of Papa was started by Kappa, the photographer.
Robert Kappa, yeah.
Robert Kappa was sent out to do a shoot on Hemingway, sort of relaxing after coming back from the Spanish Civil War in Sun Valley. And all of Hemingway's children were there, my half-brother Jack and my full-brother Gregory. The three of us were all there, and we kept calling him Papa because he never wanted to be called Dad. And so Kappa said, is it all right if I call you Papa too? And that's when it started.
Do you have any plans for your 80th birthday?
It's a very low-key party, just with friends, you know. I think an 80th birthday is great, but it's there's a great deal of sadness in reaching 80. I mean, you know damn well if you can live to be 120, but the chances are you're going to die between 80 and 90.
And so do you think of that as you turn 80?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, you start thinking of Hemingway started thinking about dying at an extraordinarily early age. One of his favorite sayings was, your one and only life.
And do you think what he wrote gives life to people beyond himself included?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think that literature is what I think intelligent people have instead of dope.
Well, I think we could probably both come up with a list of people who've tried to combine the two.
Well, yes. Yes.
Now that you've turning 80, do you think of your father a lot?
Oh, yes. When you're 80, you live more in the past than in the present.
So you think of you and your father when you were how old, may I ask?
Oh, gosh, many different ages. Sometimes I think of him when I could just barely remember him, you know, when he was just someone who kissed you and you didn't really want to be kissed because the whiskers were a little bit rough on your face. And later on, it was, you know, when he came to Africa on his second trip, and we'd be riding at night, oh, just having fun, you know. No, I remember him in every stage of his life.
Mr. Hemingway, a real pleasure talking to you. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure here.
Patrick Hemingway speaking with us from Helena, Montana. He turns 80 years old today. And this is Weekend Edition. Linda Wertheimer will be here for a couple of weeks while I'm away. Boy, I hope she lets me back. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.